I encourage people around the world, please sit down with your government, sit down with your university, sit down with the scientists and the researchers, and really ensure that you're all working together, that everything that is there is together working as a committee or a group or however it manages to evolve. Everyone has to have a seat at the table. And if they don't have a seat at the table, you don't hear their voice. And so the indigenous people who've been working with plants, they have to have a seat at the head of the table, as far as I'm concerned, because they hold the heritage wisdom and the ancestor lineage. And to not be included in the discussion is cultural appropriation. Again, the same old story that we've been doing endlessly forever. We need everyone a seat at the table.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Psychedelic Conversations. I have a returning guest in the house, Reverend Dr. Jessica Rochester. Welcome. Thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me on the show.
This is our second meeting. So this is our second time sharing this space with you. And it's been such a honor and privilege to follow your work. And actually, I got to know you more after we had our conversation. And I recognize the wisdom behind it and the value that you give so much to our, you know, upcoming sort of psychedelic leaders in the space. And of course, I have my own few questions that I wanted to dig into today. I think you kind of have an idea what they may be, because we've been exchanging a lot of messages recently, if that's okay. And of course, I just wanted to say a few lines from your bio for our listeners, in case they have only just discovered us and you. And we'll link the first episode in the show notes as well, if you wanted to check it out. We had a wonderful conversation not long ago. And so I'm really thrilled to have Dr. Rochester back with us. She is the author of The Ayahuasca Awakening, A Guide to Self-Discovery, Self-Mastery, and Self-Care. Volume 1 and 2. She's an ordained interfaith minister with a doctorate in divinity, a transpersonal counselor and educator. She trained in the work of psychiatrist Roberto
Assaggioli. Yes.
And trained with Stanislav Grof. Again, he's one of our mentors and teachers. And Dr. Rochester is the Madrina or Sur de Montreal. So I'm going to need your assistance in saying these words, please. So you founded the church, Santa Dime, in Canada. And yes. How would I pronounce it? Madrina or?
It's Madrina. You don't, in Portuguese, you don't say the H. And it's Seo de Montreal. Seo means sky. And it refers to kind of the astral. So and its Santo Daime is a Brazilian tradition that was founded over 100 years ago by a man named Mr. Irineo. And he had apprenticed with the Ayahuascaras, the tribal people who used, indigenous people who used ayahuasca. As perhaps many of your listeners might know, that ayahuasca has a very long tradition in the Amazon basin for being used in ritual, for initiations, for community healing and connecting, for divination. It is said that the plants would be taken when the tribe really needed to understand how to manage whatever it was that they were facing. Also for them to learn, they felt that by taking these plants, they would know where what they were hunting was, where the fish was in the river, and where the creatures were in the woods, for them to be able to track and find their food and sustenance. And so it's millennial, the use of these plants. They only came into notice through, Mr. Ineo getting the instructions to use these plants in sacred ritual and in a way that was community-based and not so much the medicinal way that it was also used. We have to acknowledge and respect that part of the indigenous heritage use has been medicinal, that these plants would be mixed with, in an admixture, with other healing plants to assist with healing or support to people in the community who needed it. And so not the medicinal way, okay? And what Master Ineo was shown was only these two plants, the leaf of one tree and the vine, no admixtures. And he was given, by his encounters with the divine feminine, he was given the inspiration to begin this little community of people who started singing hymns that he was receiving from the astral. The same way in the indigenous heritage use, they would receive calls, and they would receive these what are called calls or pontos. They would be calls that they would have for to acknowledge certain beings and certain astral dimensions, let's call them. And so that tradition passed straight into the Santo Daime. And now they became hymns praising the beings of the astrals, and then prayers work their way in. It's a very eclectic practice. I brought it back in 1996 from a center in the Amazon and founded the church and officially opened it spiritually in 1997. And then I was in my apprentice for 14 years, from 1996 until the year 2010, when we became independent. I worked with the Canadian government until 2017 to receive the legalization permission, the import permission to be able to import, and the ability to store and serve our sacrament in our rituals only. So no one should think that ayahuasca is legal in Canada, that anyone can order it and bring it in and use it. No. It's like a driver's license. This is how I explain it to everybody in the hopes that they understand it. The same way you have to have a driver's license to drive the car. Okay, you have to have a Section 56 exemption to be able to, another example would be a bar license, that a restaurant has to have a bar license, or, you know, some kind of organization has to have a bar or hotel or what have you, to be able to serve alcohol. If they don't have that license, they can't serve alcohol, you know. And so I'm always astounded when people think, oh, okay, we can do what we want now. And it's like, no, pay attention. You know, any serious recognized indigenous line and religious line has every right to go and present themselves at the Office of Controlled Substances Health Canada and to legitimately present themselves and their principles, beliefs, practices, and be taken seriously. You know?
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for giving us the overview of Santo Daime and its roots, and a clear picture of what is it that we need to really learn and acknowledge about these medicines. So in Canada, and I'm guessing in US, there's different locations where Santo Daime they can find. Netherlands, I think there's one Santo Daime.
Yeah, there's quite a few throughout Europe. Now, there's been different court cases, and some, depending on, you know, it's been a bit complicated because different laws in different countries. And although there are kind of global laws on these things, the plants themselves are protected. They're heritage plants under the United Nations Convention. They're protected. However, once you take the plants and convert them into something that you are going to then ingest, then you need permission. So there's been, you know, finding, you know, not just in Canada, also in the United States, it was Jeffrey Bronfman of the Unio de Vegetal Sister Church There are Union de Vegetal branches in Canada and in the United States, also licensed. And so people who are genuinely interested in following these paths, then, you know, they will be able to find legal centers, hopefully not too far away from where they are. People who are just looking for some kind of la-la experience need to understand that these spiritual traditions are very serious. They're very serious. And they really need to inform themselves of the principles and the practices.
Amazing.
It's not a rave. It's not a rave. It's not a disco where people are taking pills. It's not that.
Yeah. And this is, I'm so grateful you said this. I think this sets the tone of our conversation already. And this is the direction I wanted to go with you. And I find you very direct and very honest. And I really love your approach. the level of also humbleness is just remarkable. So please tell us. Yeah, please.
Thank you. I can bow to all my teachers. Jack Kornfield, a great teacher, and many of the madrinas and padrinas in the Santo Daime who have been my mentors and my teachers. Stanislav Grof, of course. I can bow to all my teachers going back 50 years who have contributed to the deep understanding that those of us who work in non-ordinary states of consciousness, and particularly beyond people who have these profound experiences, that the first thing that we have to learn is that to come away with a sense of humility, humbleness, and awe, wonder. If we come away with God and I are one in a way that is, right up there in a narcissistic bubble, I'm grand now. Every now and again, there's these wonderful little cartoons, that travel around. They get kind of dusted off and brought up to today's kind of standards of drawing and things like that. But they're old. They go back a long time, in which it's like, oh, I've had this experience of enlightened. I'm enlightened. Okay. And then the ego takes over and it's like, I'm better than everybody else. And there is this spiritual narcissism that can happen to anyone. Okay. It can happen to anyone. We all have to be mindful of it. And again, I bow to all my great teachers. Stan Grof used to say, please don't project your higher self onto me, because if I accept it, then I have to accept your lower self projection. You don't get one without the other.
Yeah.
So this is the trick for the people who are the participant in experiences of non-ordinary states of consciousness, whatever, however mediated. And it is the challenge on the other side for the person who is responsible, the person who's accountable, the person who has the authority to be leading the ritual, or in the case of the therapeutic use of, let's say, psychedelics, the facilitator, okay, the guide. And so it's beholden on them to be watching, to be aware of these things, to be watching for them, and to understand when they happen, because they will happen. It's like, oh man, did I ever do a good job of that, Okay, well, that's great. You did a good job. And now long, slow, deep breath and get over yourself.
Yeah. So this is the role of the guide. So I have this beautiful quote around the same time that I discovered your post around where you gently addressed this bubble of, self-acclaimed healer and the shaman and the facilitator, right? So it's increasing at the moment.
Yes.
Everybody wants to jump in on that wagon, and everybody wants to be have a title of a psychedelic facilitator of some sort. So
if I could interrupt you, please, Susan. Please. One moment. I think we need to kind of sort out in a facilitator or guide. We are going to assume, just to make sure we're using language in the same way, and that it's, I love doing kind of definitions of the language we're using, so that you and I, The host, the guest, and the listeners are working with the same kind of understanding of the language. So for me, a facilitator or a guide is somebody who has training and credentialing. And it does not matter to me if they are a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a medical doctor, if they are trained and credentialed in any field. So for example, I was working fairly closely with the spiritual care providers, and there's a whole organization across it. And this is a, you know, these are serious people and they want to work. They're working with people who are dying. So they're ministers and they're clergy and they're, you know, they want to be able to learn how to do this. So they've been very serious about learning some tools to be able to work in non-ordinary states of consciousness. And so they are going to be taking the words guide and facilitator very seriously. It's not just like a trip sitter. Okay, that's kind of something else. That's a conversation. I hope nobody hears me disparaging any of these words. Okay. It's just naming what's the difference here. And then you have words like curanderas and curanderas, male and female healers, who are given that title, or shaman. They are given that title by their tribe, their community. It's not a self-acclaimed thing. They are apprenticed often from the time they're a child. The elders, shamans, curanderas will be looking at who has the skills in the children. Ah, that one's going to be a warrior. Ah, that one's going to be a carver. That one will be leading the songs. Okay. This one, looks like they're already going after and opening and studying and wanting to learn the plants and wanting to learn the chants and the calls. And, you know, and so they watch to see the gifts, the strengths, the, you know, the talents, the call, the mission that comes emerging in the children. And then they gently start apprenticing them in whatever calling it looks and strength that they have. Now, that's vastly different. And so it's the tribe that announces them as shaman when they are, and there will be a ritual around that, not vastly different from a graduation ceremony where you're handed your, you know, your university degree and everybody applauds and, you know, and, or, you know, your acceptance into a certain, you know, what have you, association or what have you. And so there's these rituals that mark the completion of, or the stages of, we can use some of the Eastern, like the Eastern traditions of martial arts, is they have belts. You know, I don't want to name them because I'll probably mess them up, but I think like the brown belt and the black belt are the highest, maybe the white and the yellow or the green or the beginners, okay? But each time the, you know, the Tai Chi master or the, you know, Taekwondo master watches the students to see who's ready for the next belt.
Yeah.
You know, who's paying attention and they've learned the moves and they're understanding the breathing and they're getting it. And okay, now you're ready for your next belt. And so there's this apprenticeship in so many areas in life. You know, flying a plane. Okay, you pass, get your pilot's license, but to get there, you know, you have to start way off. You start with a two-seater Cessna, and only when the instructor says, okay, I think you're ready for solo.
Yeah, you know, this is wonderful. I love this analogy, and it applies to everything. It's not just
everything in life.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, everything in life it applies to.
Yeah, it's about learning to be apprentice.
Yes,
and willing to be in that lineage.
In the study, it doesn't matter what it. There's this wonderful story. Gosh, I may not remember his name. World famous celloist. And he was elderly, if he's still alive, I'm not sure. And he was being interviewed, this is many years ago. And he was asked, do you still practice every day? And he says, oh, yes, of course I still practice every day. And the interviewer says, well, you know, would you like to share anything about that? And so this, you know, world-renowned cellist says, well, I think I'm coming along.
This is wonderful. The level of humility there, incredible.
Yes, I think I'm coming along. You know, wow. The mastering. Mastery is not, mastery of anything really is an ongoing process up until our last breath, whether it's art, music, science. A doctor practices medicine. Has anybody ever stopped and thought about that?
Wow.
Because they know that you have to do it and do it and do it. And you learn more with every single patient because, you know, I've had deep conversations with physicians about this. But what do you mean by practicing medicine? You know, and some of them pretty well known, like Larry Dossey, Stan Grof and Paul Grof. Okay. And practicing medicine, yeah, because every patient is different and you can learn, but then it's actually practicing the medicine that's where you get all your experience and that's where you really learn. You know?
This is so valuable. Thank you so much. So now in a world of the you know, the psychedelic renaissance currently, when you see and hear discussions around learning to work with the medicines in this case, of course, the plant medicines and psychedelic medicines, in 2 years, 3 years of courses, certification programs, what are your feelings around those kind of educational platforms providing these certifications?
Well, I'm a strong believer in education and credentialing. I'm an advisor to the programs at the University of Ottawa. I've sat on committees across Canada, not just for conferences, for example, spiritual care providers, for groups out west, for the universities out west, Vancouver Island University, the people there who really are developing programs and want people to sit on committees, to be advisors, to say, hey, you better include this and you better look at that, you know, and each person has something to offer to make sure that there's a well-rounded, that the programs, usually master level, that are being developed, will really do the best to cover the groundwork around ethics and non-ordinary states of consciousness and, you know, what is it that is essential and what is kind of extra, you know? So I think that the accredited universities and institutes that are developing programs, like, great, good for them. And if they really try and standardize with the other institutes and universities, they should be standardizing to make sure that that these programs are transferable, you know, and that they are being held to a certain standard of accountability and ethics. I mean, I'm going to go back to the MAPS conference in Oakland in, I think it was 2013, so 10 years ago. Where I had this little vision that we needed to be talking about a few things. And so I chatted with a couple of friends and colleagues, and Ken Tupper, well-known in Canada for his work, and Bill Labate and Jeffrey Bronfman. And so people well-known in the community. And I called them up and I said, I have this idea about making a little meeting. And kind of in my head, I got maybe 10 or 12 of us, you know, sitting around, I don't know, a dining room table in one of the restaurants hotel where the conference was. And they went, yeah, good idea. Okay, yeah, these things, we can talk about them. Yeah, go for it. You know, start setting it up. And then the next thing we knew, we had like a ton of people interested in participating. And so we decided we caught the last room that would only hold, the hotel says that only holds 45 people. Okay, well, that room was filled out with people standing around the edges and at the door. And we had to make a meeting the next day for all the people who heard about it and said, I would have signed up for that. So there's about 100 people who really want to talk about legalization, ethics, accountability, and training. And here I was standing up saying to all these people, guys, you can't just start calling yourself a shaman unless you've done your apprenticeship and unless the people you are apprenticing with so give you permission to do so. So all you folks who are setting up these kind of, I know I started referring them as hybrid circles, okay, because they're They're not the religious lines. They're not the heritage indigenous shamanic lines. They're kind of circles that are using either our sacred plants or other sacred plants and or psychedelics. Okay. And I was speaking mainly to them saying, guys, you know, you need to organize, get yourselves together. You need to look at your credentialing. You need to be, are you going to be taken seriously? Because your governments will not take you seriously. If you want to be taken seriously by your governments, then you need to look at these pieces. Okay. And it was taken very seriously, you know, by the people who were there, which was grand. And, you know, out of it, I encouraged everybody. Some people came up to me afterwards, Brian Rush, Dr. Brian Rush, you know, senior scientist at CAMH here in Toronto in Canada, and said, you know, like, what should I do? And I said, do research. And out of that, there was a bunch of researchers from all around, and they just started, and this is so essential. So, you know, I've got this little broken record that's been going on for a long time now, which is do research, support the scientists, participate in their research if you can. Almost every serious researcher that's contacted us, I've asked our church, can we please, you know, these are serious people, can we please support the science and the research? And so it's on the one hand supporting the science and the research, on the other hand it's supporting the educational institutes who, let's hope they get it right, you know, we want them, let's get it right this time. Okay. And in standardizing and making these courses available to people. And then you have the people who think they don't need any training and they don't need any supervising, which is fine if they have the, you know, kind of the acknowledgement, acceptance, and credentialing. Let's keep using these words. Because we all understand what they mean, to grandfather in. Now, shall I define grandfathering? Would that be helpful?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Okay. So what grandfathering is grandfathering means you've already been doing this for many, many years. Okay. And so the fact that you already have, like, for example, there's certain people who have all the academic credentials, who got involved in working with sacred plants, okay, and then, you know, wanted to bring and work with. So people like that would get grandfathered in because they have so much training and so much experience. And if they've been taking people down to Brazil or Peru or what have you, and working with local people, and all of that is kind of in place, all of that kind of heritage credentialing, you know, then they would be grandfathered in. They would not have to go back to school to get a two-year degree. Do you understand? So, you know, these are deep conversations that I had with the Office of Controlled Substances. We had many meetings after we published Entheogens and Psychedelics in Canada proposal for a new paradigm. And as soon as we published, I made a meeting with the Office of Controlled Substance director and the science manager and, you know, some of the other people there, policy manager, the people through 23 years of working with the office, you get to know the who's doing what in the office, you know. And so as a committee, we presented our findings and our recommendations and our concerns about risks and benefits. And so this has been an ongoing conversation. And I encourage people around the world, please sit down with your government, sit down with your university, sit down with the scientists and the researchers, and really ensure that you're all working together, that everything that is there is speaking, is together working as a committee or a group or however it manages to evolve. But you need to include all the players. Everyone has to have a seat at the table. And if they don't have a seat at the table, you don't hear their voice. And so the indigenous people who've been working with plants, they have to have a seat at the head of the table, as far as I'm concerned, because they hold the heritage wisdom and the ancestor lineage. And to not be included in the discussion is cultural appropriation. Again, the same old story that we've been doing endlessly forever. And so we need everyone a seat at the table.
Yes, I love your
question. Does this make sense? Yes.
It makes absolute sense. I'm just listening and everything I'm hearing is just like a light bulb moment for me. And I hope our listeners are really enjoying this. I think this is psychedelic education at its best, coming from you and your experience and your years of being in the lineage and apprenticing and leading. So I'm always in this space of like, how do we tackle with this new age self-empowerment of like, I don't need anyone to show me, guide me, teach me. I don't know if you remember, there was an article that really stirred a lot of conversations between people. And then there was some people were taking sides, you know, should these medicines be explored by individuals? Should they be always guided? Should they be just, you know, because a lot of people argue that they came to their enlightenment or awakening through self-exploration without a guide, without a trip sitter, without a shaman. So it's a lot of mixed conversations out there, and I'd love to hear your perspective.
You know, you've really encapsulated the situation very well. Thank you. There's this wide range of experience and operation and practice. There are people who have just sat with whatever particular sacred plant or substance, psychedelic substance, they have felt called to work with and have felt that they have had enormous benefit and, felt that they've had transcendent experiences that have been really supportive and helpful. Well, you know, that no one's going to take that away from them. I mean, that's their experience. Does that make them qualified to work with other people? That's my question. How does that make you qualified to work with other people?
Yeah.
That's just the question, you know? Just because you took it and you had great experiences, does that mean that you know? Can I tell a story?
Yes, please.
Okay, so everybody who knows me knows that I love stories. And I hope you haven't heard this one before, but anyway. Okay, so I'm down in Brazil. I'm new on the path. Okay, I'm the kind of person that I'm saying hello, a supervision teacher. I remember sitting in a meeting where I brought a group down, and I was like a year and a half, 2 years in, and I was deep in my apprenticeship. You know, in constant communication with the elders and the senior people. I was traveling with them. I was hosting comitivas in my house and picking their brains and, you know, drinking daimi with them and being in the works was one thing. And then it was intensely working with them around the works and traveling to Brazil at least twice a year and traveling around with comitivas in the United States and Canada and in Europe and, you know, really soaking it up, visiting all the other churches that I possibly could to try and learn as much as I could. And I remember saying to one of the padrinos in a meeting, I said, I feel like you put a toddler in charge of the nursery. You know, now I had trained in Assagioli's work. I had trained with Stan Grof, okay? Not just in his work, but directly with him. Christina Grof was still part of the training when I first went into the training. And I'm saying, I feel like a toddler in charge of the nursery, you know, and he cracked up. And so did Madrina Rita when I gave her a similar version of that. And she said, no, you can't think that. You're on the path. You're following the light. You have your calling. You have to have confidence in it. And, you know,
I really love that.
Yeah. You know, so it's like inside of me, I didn't have this, hey, I got it all experience. I kind of had the reverse. Now, maybe it's just my character or, you know, my teachers did a good job. My spiritual teachers did a good job, you know, And yet we have seen, I have seen in works, I have seen people who it's their first work or their second work and they're poof, you know, I'm channeling Jesus. And I remember that happening in a sharing circle after a work. It was down in a church actually in the States. And I was with Alex Polari, had been leading the work. I was sitting pretty much next to him, and I sort of out of the corner of my eye, like, how's he going to handle this? Okay. How's he going to handle this? It's going to be very interesting, you know. And I've watched how, you know, people go into, you know, thank God for the training with Stan Grof and other, it's understanding deep process, understanding how to support it. It is wonderful if people sit and you know, like the lotus flower opening, and you see these, you know, all the flowers and the chakras open, and you're in the light and everything's beautiful and everything. Well, that's grand. But what if your experience is you're down in the pit of hell, or you're in the walking through the valley of the shadow of death, or you find yourself swimming in the sea of lost souls, you know? And I talk to people about this, and I, you know, don't pitch your tent next to the sea of lost souls, you know. And if you've had this really difficult experience, the people who, and this is why Stan Grof did his training, people who go through that training have a very good understanding of deep process and how to support it. And if you haven't had an equivalent, then you could get into very deep waters. Another analogy I use is scuba diving. You know, I scuba dived for years. I totally adored it. You start in a swimming pool, okay? You have a master diver. They're called master divers, okay? Because they've got all their certificates and they've done all their training and what have you. You start in a swimming pool. Now, I'm a swimmer. I mean, I seriously swim, okay? And so, you know, I'm not a little paddle around with a floaty thing, and that's all grand. I don't, it's just, I'm just saying my level of seriousness, okay? And so I'm learning to scuba dive in a pool, and they put brown paper in your goggles for one of the sessions, so you can't see. Because they say, you know, it could happen. You could be scuba diving and a current could come up and it could stir up all the sand or the mud or whatever it is. And you're going to have to feel confident to go by feel, okay, and to find your way, you know, by looking at your compass as best as you can see it. You're going to have to find your way. And so this all happens in a swimming pool, basically, with two lifeguards, never mind the master divers, with lifeguards standing there to make sure if anyone gets into a panic attack or something, that they get out of the water quick and handle it. And then you do an open dive that's only, you do not go lower than 30 feet because that's your first atmosphere, right? Underwater, you don't go lower than 30 feet. So by grades, you work your way up to the most difficult dive I did was a cave entry at 140 feet. It was spectacular, just off the coast of Cozumel. And I got great diving stories for another time over a cup of tea when we're not being recorded. So this is how you learn how to scuba dive, you know? And so how do people think that they can actually take people? Would you go down just because I had marvelous experiences? I never thought that I could take people scuba diving. That wouldn't have occurred to me.
Yeah.
Just because I like flying in a plane, that I can fly the plane.
Yeah. You know? And this is happening. Yeah, this is happening in the psychedelic.
This is happening. Yeah. This is happening. And where will it lead to? Well, you know what? There's something that we can learn from history. And in the Old Testaments, the old records and stories of thousands of years ago, how did a person get the name of being a prophet? How were they declared a prophet? Can you answer?
No, but I do have one suspicion.
Okay.
That I can go with one particular. There's a recollection of his life that he used to go and meditate a lot in a cave. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So actually, how you were considered to be a prophet was because what you divined actually came to pass. And if you...
Please repeat that again.
How people were named as prophets was because what they divined, what they saw, actually came to pass.
Wow.
Yeah. You didn't get to be called, not you didn't get to be called, you know, Ezekiel and Elijah and all those heavyweight prophets of the Old Testament. You notice there's not a lot of them.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of the prophets. But yeah. The ones who were called prophets, it's because they could look at a battle and they could say, I don't think you want to go in and fight them today. And then they'd understand why today wasn't a good day to go and fight, you know. Now, so there are people who have this intuition, this premonition, this deep sense of understanding. And when that was really finely tuned, then they would earn over time, they would earn the title of prophet. And so we have in history, we have, you know, it's all the same thing is you earn, you apprentice, you train, you earn, you know, that wonderful story of, is it Ezekiel is carried up in a fiery chariot and turns around and he casts his mantle. Well, it probably wasn't a physical thing, but he casts his mantle on his apprentice prophet, who then becomes the next great prophet. And so you have this transmission from teacher to teacher. Okay. Yeah. The things that I have received that have been transmitted to me by my teachers, that have been transmitted to me by the Daimi, who is the teacher of all teachers, okay, the plants themselves. But we need both. In my books, especially in volume one, I go very deeply into this conversation about the need for teachers and why we need teachers and even how to recognize a good teacher and what to go and run away from. You know, we can cover a few of that if you're interested. But how important it is to be able to, you know, recognize what is going to be good about a teacher or a guide and how to learn to trust them and to respect them and to take their teachings and bring them into ourselves, knowing that they may have some transformational process within us that will then take us to the next level in that teaching.
Yeah, this is so wonderful. And I just wanted to tie it with what I tried to share about the prophet is that I just wanted to actually say that because he wasn't just an ordinary person, he was probably deeply inquiring about the nature of existence, spending a lot of time in a cave. It's almost like he earned that process of like awakening somehow.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he probably, you know, a lot of things are left out of the stories for whatever reason. That's a whole other conversation, you know, but a lot of things are left out of the stories that are gathered together into various books for whatever reason. Okay. But there's incredible stories about, you know, I've just, you know, shared one of the mantle passing to another, but this is what happens. Is they go off and they train with masters and they come back. You know, people think, there's these wonderful books about this. What happened to the six missing years of Jesus? How come there's nothing written about it? And yet there's wonderful writings that have been gathered through the years. But he actually went into the further east and studied in the Eastern traditions. And there's writings about him coming to visit that have been gathered and printed up, which sounds it's the same way John the Baptist appears out of the desert. Okay, well, where was he coming from? Why don't they talk about that? Who did he train with? And what did he do that brought him back to his tribal homeland and want to bring these teachings? Okay. And so we can see that, you know, they don't just fall from the sky. And yes, there are people who do have profound experiences and get a profound vision of something and without any more to do, just, you know, go out and do it. And who chooses to follow them, chooses to follow them. Who chooses to study with them, chooses to study with them. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. That, you know, how does that work in today's reality? That's very different from somebody who just starts speaking one day in the synagogue like Jesus did. Jesus didn't go and start grabbing people and say, you have to come and listen to me, you know, or you have to do what I say. He just started talking with the other rabbis. He's just started sharing his understanding of things and what he was learning about life, okay, what he believed about the divine feminine and masculine, you know. And then people liked what they heard. And so they started to follow him. And, you know, that's vastly different from what's happening now.
Yes,
Well, some people seem to be, based on reports, okay, and some personal experience. Some people are using sacred plants, entheogens, and psychedelics as a personal platform, okay, for their products, for their services, for their ideas, without the training, the credentialing, the apprenticeship. And that becomes a very difficult situation, because it is much easier for there to be ethical problems in that situation if the guide or the group leader, okay, does not have the training, the apprenticeship, the mentoring, the colleagues, the support system, okay, the principles, the ethic codes. If you don't have that, what's guiding you?
Yeah.
And you know, I believe that most of us are being guided by our higher self or spirit. I believe that all of us have that inside of us. Every single one of us, we may or may not be in touch with it. We may or may not be following it. A lot of people tune it out because they don't want to see or hear, know, you know.
Yeah.
In my kitchen, I love owls, and my daughter in particular, and my son-in-law give me owls of every, we might be able to see some of them around the room. They're all cluttered up on stuff, you know. And on my fridge, I have these beautiful three ceramic owls, and one of them, you know, speak no evil, hear no evil, see no evil, okay? Which is a deep teaching for another day, okay? But we can't go through life like that. I don't want to, you know, who's teaching us? Who's, are we listening? So we can have that with our higher self, you know, where we come with willful ignorance. I know I should be paying attention, willful ignorance, you know. I know I should be paying attention to this, seeing this and hearing this and listening to this and taking it in, but I choose not to because I don't want to. Because whatever it is that I'm attached to has a deeper meaning for me than letting it go. Does that make sense, what I'm
absolutely,
saying?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I was going to touch quickly on the, what are your thoughts on, you know, there is a notion that every human being is a trauma survivor, therefore maybe internally are. Yes, you just mentioned we have a higher self, whether we tune into it, tune out, whether we follow or not. But then if, let's say, the inner compass is kind of compromised and they don't really follow this higher inner self, which then puts us in a very volatile, exploitative, you know, vulnerable states, which I want to bring it back to. A lot of the people, when I stress a lot about the mentorship, having someone to keep us accountable, oversee everything, and also be someone that's all a few steps ahead of us, even just to, they know the space, the process, and the whole thing. They can sort of guide us, oversee us, and keep us accountable. This has caused a lot of controversy because at the moment, it's all about the individualistic self-empowerment, that we are all divine, that we all have this power to lead ourselves. And if it's left in the hands of another, it's just another way of suppressing, or, you know, like the historical negative thing that's just been played out a lot. I'm sure you've seen it. Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking to this and bringing this into the conversation. So at the core, okay, at the core, I, as soon as you started talking, a quote from Sheldon Kopp came up, which was, all God's children are loved, but not all of them can play the piano. So I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but if you know his work, it's so brilliant, and it's like almost brilliant existential one-liners that are geared towards, I think he was writing this you know, through the 70s. So there are older books of the era of Ram Dass and Be Here Now. Okay. And so what is that actually saying? It's like, yes, we all have, I believe this profoundly, that, you know, that we are, you're God disguised as Susan, and I'm God disguised as, you know, we can define what is God. You know, to me, it's not a male deity on a throne, although I know that's where the word comes from. So you're the goddess disguised as Susan, and I'm the goddess, you know, but I'm not the goddess. Okay. The tree is the God disguised as a tree. I mean, I'm very grateful to my Eastern teachings that blew open my little Western mind in the early 70s and said, hey, pay attention, your model's all wrong. Well, no wonder it didn't feel right being a woman with a everything male deity, okay? And so we can understand, you know, that those of us who accept this, that there is this universal consciousness, cosmic consciousness, divine consciousness, God, whatever you, I'm comfortable with all those different words, gods, goddesses, realms, divinity realms, it's all good. Okay, whatever language we use, whatever people are comfortable with, that this is alive and inside of us, that this is our true essence. This is where we came from before we incarnated. This is where we return to after we shed our human form. And that however, does not make us a god and goddess. Okay? Having these experiences and working with them should bring us to humbleness and awe and wonder. Okay? And I think this is, I'm not sure if it's, certainly we see it, we see this more of a North American view, you know, with great respect to all the wonderful gifts of my neighbors to the south. But their culture is very loud. They have a loud voice. It's like the djembe drum. Okay, it's got a loud voice in culture. And I'm not sure how, around the world, what other people think about these things that we're seeing, but it seems as if this is kind of a current cultural attitude of this identification of I don't need, I'm empowered myself. And yeah, but isn't that confusing some things? So does empowerment mean that I'm therefore qualified to do things with other people? We're back to that again, okay? That yes, we want people to feel authentic and real. I mean, I had private practice for 40 years, and you know, that was a big chunk of my work, was helping people grieve, block grief being the main source for depression and anxiety, right? Helping people grieve, helping people access their authentic self, helping people, you know, find their own inner wisdom and access in whatever way felt comfortable for them, a connection with their higher self. Could be through nature, could be through music, could be through movement, art, doesn't matter, prayer, meditation. We can all access that in our own way. And again, that doesn't make us qualified to do anything with other people. That's where it gets confused, you know? And I'm not sure where that went off the track. I've always said to people, I'm not New Age. People try and call me New Age. I'm not New Age, I'm transpersonal. And for me, the maps are very different. You know, there's beautiful gifts that came from what we call the New Age movement. You know, beautiful openings and mergings of things and everything else. And then there's this, a lot of what I call New Age fantasy, where simple truths, and I write again about this again in both volumes in various areas, I touch on this, this kind of New Age fantasy thinking. I share, I believe it's in volume 2, talking about prayer and meditation, about, and I have a deep conversation with Mai Bashina. Mai Bashina, now deceased about 6 years, 7 years ago, I've lost track. She was my main teacher for mediumship, the style of mediumship that we work with in our church. And a very important teacher for me. And she still assists us up in the astral. So, you know, I shared this New Age philosophy, some of it, with her. And I said, you know, sometimes people come into our church and they've got these ideas. I have to tell them, no, it doesn't fit. And she was horrified. And I said to her, you know, people are told, you know, that it's all the power of, you know, I believe in the power of positive thinking. I certainly do. But I'm not fantasy thinking. There's a huge difference here. And it's all got muddled up together. But all you have to do is, you know, it's this, you know, prosperity and empowerment. And all you have to do is think it and you want it and you'll get it. And the universe is going to get. Well, there is a grain of truth in that, but not how it's been packaged. Okay, the grain of truth is now way down deep in layers and layers and layers of fantasy. Okay, I have difficulty with people who slap a photo or who are told to put up a photo of what you want on your fridge and see it every day, and I'm going to get that fill in the blank. Let's call, say it's a fancy car. Okay, that's vastly different from planning and working towards taking a nice holiday or, you know, getting a new car, working and enjoying the thought of just somehow the universe is going to instantly give it to you because somehow we're special. I don't know how that got into the educational system in the United States somewhere, but you're special and you're unique. Well, yeah, once again, there's a grain of truth in that. We are each uniquely ourselves. We have something special about us, but that doesn't make us special. You know, how did that go off track so badly? And what I want to say to these people is, how does this prosperity, fantasy, new age thing that you've got going on for you, how does that work for the people who have no food, no water, no safety, no shelter, the people who have no medicine, the people who have bombs dropping on them? I mean, people who've just gone through a hurricane, a tsunami, a fill in the blank. What are they going to do? They're going to draw a picture of water and slap it on what? The wind? And say, well, the universe will give it to me because I'm special? Okay, so this whole thing falls apart for me in 2 seconds. I have never been able to support this kind of new age fantasy of I'm special, therefore I don't need teachers. I'm special. I have these experiences and the spirit's teaching me this. It's like, okay, then if for people who don't want, you know, a mentor or teacher because they feel they don't need, well, how about a group of colleagues who have, you know, so it's a colleague circle if people are. But isn't that kind of childish? I'm sorry, Susan. This is going to sound very judgmental, but I find it all very kind of teenage. You know, I've raised children. I've got grandchildren who are just about tiptoeing into the teenage years now, so watch out, you know. But isn't that kind of teenage energy?
It is.
It's an imperative thrust towards adulthood where we say, where we're pushing away our parents, I know better, I know what I'm doing, I need to explore, I need to do that. And parents are desperately trying to keep healthy boundaries and some house rules in place, okay? Because that's how it sounds. It sounds like teenagers. It sounds like something 14-year-olds would do. You know, I can go out the back of the high school and smoke cigarettes. You can't tell me what to do.
Yeah.
You know? And that's the energy when I'm talking to people like this, you know.
Yeah,
a lot of people contact me, and I'm sad to say I got quite impatient with a couple of the last of them, and I wasn't my best self, let's say. But I got quite cranky with some people because it's like, you know, first of all, they expect me to just tell them how to get an exemption or give them a copy. People have asked me, I should give them a copy of our application. Well, I'm sorry, all I can do is laugh at that because this is not happening, you know.
Wow.
It's like saying, can I have your driver's license? It's like, no, you actually have to go and earn that. You have to prove that you have what is needed to let the Office of Controlled Substances know that you will be capable they have to do this for the health and safety of the Canadian population. That's why the OCS, Office of Controlled Substances, is under Health Canada. It's the health and safety of the people that you will be working with. Hey, you just want to go out and take a substance by yourself and put on some music or sit down in nature or meditate or pray or something. Well, okay, you know, right now the OCS and Health Canada sort of do this for very tiny amounts. They're not going to arrest or prosecute or anything like that. But once you start serving people, that's a whole other whole other category of stuff. So, you know, with all due respect to everybody who has possibly really good intentions and genuinely wants to help.
Yes.
I have two words to say to you. Wake up.
Yeah.
And wake up. This is the reality. The reality is, if you're going to work with people, it's one thing to just do it yourself. But if you are going to serve people, you are fully accountable. Every time I serve Danny, I am accountable. And every time there's a part of me thinking, really? I'm still doing this.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of responsibility. It's
huge.
A lot of responsibility. Yeah.
It's huge.
It's not just a lark, you know.
Thank you so much for speaking to this. It's not about even the laws and this, you know, war on drugs, because we got this whole another area people, oh, it's about the war on drugs, we should all have access. But then, you know, Dr. Rochester, in my beginning, my early time in the medicine, I was very lucky to practice and attend as a participant to learn and to also do my work with an indigenous person. And each time I, in a ceremony, a breaking open moment we would witness, somebody really going into their grief and really being activated.
Mm-hmm.
And it was carnage. And every morning I would sit and think carefully, is this where I want to go into?
Yes.
Because yes. This is really, really deep, and it should never be taken
really
lightly.
Deep.
Yeah.
Yes, we call them difficult passages, and they are very common in non-ordinary states of consciousness. When I first started in the ashram in 1971, I was going every day after work, Monday to Friday, because that became my sanity. Okay, so I'd leave my office with my suit and my heels and everything, and I'd get into the ashram of yoga and meditate and chant and, you know, Om Namah Shivaya and until you're in silence. Okay, and I was really lucky because that yoga teacher, she was the kind of Quebec guru at the time in the early 70s. She's long since passed, and she had a back room for noisy meditators who needed to scream and cry and bang. And, you know, we'd start into the meditation and she'd go, okay, those of you who need to go, go. You know, we'd hear weeping and banging and coming from the back room. And it was like, okay, deep process. And what did the Dalai Lama say? He said, if you have not grieved your life, you have not begun to meditate.
Yeah.
So this is another thing, is that some of these beautiful Eastern traditions that had teachers who apprenticed since they were children. Have you seen the apprenticeship in to be a Buddhist monk? They start them off at, 7 years old. Okay. So deep, deep, long apprenticeships with a deep understanding of the realms that you can touch and experience in the non-ordinary state. You know, deep, deep, deep. Well, you need that.
Yeah.
You need that experience and wisdom and to be able to understand and work with and hold the space for people in difficult passages and to ensure that they get the follow-up that they need, you know.
Yeah. I think it's the lack of discernment, I believe, you know, because of the trending, you know, when there's a lack of discernment, it's like hard to pick a teacher, or even people really fall for different things. I mean, I get every day almost like confrontational messages like, yeah, but, you know, it's not that easy to find an authentic coach or a guide anymore, or because it's all.
And they may be true in saying that, but then let them form a group of colleagues and agree on some ethical principles. I wrote a code of ethics for the Santo Daini because there wasn't one. And I trusted Jack Kornfield when he said, if you've joined a spiritual tradition and they don't have a code of ethics, write one yourself and take it to the elders, you know. And I sent that code before I gave it to the elders down to Jack Kornfield, asked him if he would please look at it and see if I left anything else or out or concluded. And he wrote back. He says, no, it's perfect the way it is. You're doing a great gift for the Santo Daini. It's up on our website, and it says very clearly, you are welcome. please take this code of ethics into your own. You know, it took years before some other churches would adopt it. There's still some who don't. That's for them to decide. But the very least is if somebody is truly operating from a place of feeling called and well intentions, the very least they can do, if they cannot get the kind of supervision, mentoring, and guiding that they are hoping to get, okay, then they must form at least a couple of three or four colleagues, okay, who are working in the line and who you can establish together, okay, let's choose a code of ethics that we want to work with together, that we will support each other with, that we will become a little support circle for each other of peers, so a peer support group. And this is the very least, you know, if people feel like, oh, I don't want a teacher, I don't need a guide, or even I can't find one. Well, you know what? I have a hard time with I can't find one. Okay, so maybe you can't find a, you know, if you're working with MDMA, then, you know, there's lots of people who've done the research and the science. There's lots of people who you can say, do you mind, you know, can you point to somebody who's been working in it who can help mentor me in this? Okay, if you're working with, you know, whatever it is that people are working with, there are people who've been working with it. Working with LSD, go read Stan Grof's work. What would he have to say about this? Guess what? He worked with a team. So you can actually, there. Have you asked? Would be my, have you asked? Have you asked anybody? Have you gone to your local university and find out, is there anybody working in this university in non-ordinary states of consciousness and consciousness? And you may find that, yes, there's a whole bunch of people either in anthropology or Department of Religions, anthropology. You're going to find people who are going to say, sure, I'm willing to spend a little time with you or sit on a committee or find a master's or a better a doctoral or postdoctoral student who's in that field, you know, who says, yes, actually, I've read a lot about that and I'm very willing to be a soundboard for you, you know. So one of my concerns is these people don't ask. Now, I don't know why. Is it lazy? Is it scared? Is it scared that they're going to be told you don't know what you're doing? Because if somebody's doing something and they don't ask for help because they're scared that they're going to be told you don't know what you're doing, then that's the first problem. Yeah. Is if they don't realize that they don't know what they're doing, then that's what they need to look at first.
Yeah. This is so brilliant and wonderful. Thank you so much for all the wisdom that you shared today. I know we're coming to the end of our conversation. I just keep wanting to have you back every
okay,
month.
Okay, so have me back. Yes, I'm all good to continue this conversation, you know, get back in touch with me.
Please do, because I think we all need a lot of guidance in this space. Yes. We all need authentic, truthful conversations and yeah, we're here for it, for sure. And you're yes. The perfect guide for us, the teacher.
Oh, don't go flattering me now. All I am is passing on what I have learned. And some of it I've learned the hard way, okay? And some of it has been really difficult teachings. Again, I share a lot of stuff in my books. If people read my books, they're going to get a really good understanding of what questions they should be asking of themselves. And, you know, what kind of support system or peer group they should be creating.
Yes, that's wonderful. So we'll have your book in the links as well. Although the title is Ayahuasca Awakenings, it feels like you're sharing a lot of the universal truths, not just based.
That's why it's Ayahuasca Awakenings, a guide to self-discovery, self-mastery, and self-care. The original title of the book was The Study. Okay. And then it was Stan Grof said to me, study. I don't know if I like his title. Okay. And then the you know, because he read the book way before it got published. And then it got broken into two books. And the publisher said, you know, you really should be putting something more in the title that says more about what the book's about, you know. And so it's like, okay. So I prayed about it, and that's kind of how it came to me. But afterwards, I thought, no, people are going to get turned off because they think it's just me journeying in ayahuasca, which it isn't. You know, it's all the teachings I've gathered up, what I've learned in 27 years of drinking and serving, and you know, 50 years on my own spiritual path, more than 50 years on my own spiritual path. I put everything I've learned in those two books, and I'm still learning. Actually, I haven't put everything I've learned up. My next book, I would like to be about mediumship, because that's a whole deep conversation, because a lot of things that get awoken inside of people is mediumship. And I think what we're seeing, part of what we're seeing with people who are self-declaring as shamans or mediums or healers, is all wrapped up in mediumship that's being woken, connections that are being made, and them not having the framework to work within.
Wow. What a
another gift. Conversation.
Another, many of another. What a gift. Thank you so much. And where can our listeners find you? Just right off the bat, because I know we'll have it in the show notes, but some people may be listening.
You can find me through my website, which is www.revdrjessicarochester, all one word, all lowercase, .com.
Beautiful.
Just my name with Rev Doctor. And so if you just even Google Jessica Rochester, you should find me easily.
And I would highly recommend them to follow you on LinkedIn. I think you drop nuggets.
Oh, thank you. I'm just about to drop another one, hopefully by the end of the weekend.
Look forward to it. And thank you so much. What a gift. Thank you for your time. And look forward to another one soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Hope you guys enjoyed this session. And if you have any questions, please do share. Drop a comment below, don't be shy, and you can get in touch with Dr. Rochester and myself for any questions. And don't forget to follow Dr. Rochester on LinkedIn. Highly recommended. I'll see you guys on the next one. Bye for now. Thank you so much for joining us. Psychedelic Conversations podcast is designed to educate, inform, and expand awareness. For more information, please head over to psychedelicconversations.com. You can also share with your friends or leave a review so that we can reach more people. You can also join us in our private Facebook group to keep the conversation going. This show is for information purposes only, and it is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.